Vita 1-8.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So good to be with you guys. So good to be in the presence of God with other believers. I really enjoy that every time I get a chance to do that. Good worship, by the way. I really enjoyed you guys singing out of the Bible. I noticed that. That's something I don't see in too many churches these days. So yeah, it is interesting we ended up in this church thanks to Jim. He has a good friend of mine as well, Rene Friesen. Me and him have regular coffees about every week, two or three times, and Rene is a good friend of Jim, so that's how we got to know each other. And Fort Davis, we've been driving through there many, many times when we go to Dallas. Just this time, we couldn't come from Mexico. We had to fly to Dallas, drive 8 hours back, and then we're here. We're almost back home. It's actually only 5 hours to home. So it's very interesting how that works. But nonetheless, we're here. And my beautiful wife, Erna, is with me. We have three kids, Armando and Nayel and Jackie. They are 21, 18, and 17. They're all back home. They're all pretty much grown up. So, well, just the smallest one is still underage. But they're doing well. They each have a good job. And so we're happy for them. Just a little background on who I am, who my wife is. I grew up in southern Mexico. That's where I was born and raised. Till I was 18. And that's when my wife's parents moved to Chihuahua, Mexico, as missionaries to do some work amongst the Mennonite people. So our background is Mennonite, like he was saying. And they were doing some work amongst the old order Mennonites that were still on buggies and horses and that. And so a good portion of our Mexican Mennonite community is actually, they claim to be Christians, but they do not believe in Christ as their Savior at all. People that in their church start believing that get kicked out for accepting Christ. It's very weird. So anyway, that's where her parents came and worked. And so that was 1995, I think they came. Yes. And so 1996, I found out that there was this girl from Canada, came with her parents to Casas Grandes. I found out through a newspaper. And I cut out the little newspaper clip where her picture was in, and I went up to my mom. I was 16 at the time. Told my mom, I will marry this girl. This is my wife. And my mom said, bless your heart, I hope you can. And there she is. I married her. 23 years later, here we are. We moved to Canada just before we got married. We got married in Canada. We had our three kids there, lived there 10 years, and it's, just so you know, very cold in Canada. I never felt at home in Canada. So then I took my whole family down to Mexico, and we've lived there ever since, 13 years now, almost 14, something like that. And it's been good. Her brother, Denver, whom you might have seen on the video, who has all seen the videos, some of them. That was Denver, that's my brother-in-law, her brother. He moved down there as well after we did. They have a child that has cerebral palsy. And that was the reason they moved down there, because they could find better medical help in Mexico. His dream since the age of 17 has always been to work with orphans. And he never knew exactly how or what. At one point he wanted to go to Africa and all that stuff. But due to the condition of their child, they ended up in Mexico. And he said, okay, we're here. So let's start right here. There's plenty of orphans in Mexico. And so he always wanted to, so I'm just giving you a little history on Vida 180. He always wanted to be self-sustained. He did not want to ask for donations, ever, to anybody. He's a very self-made man. He wants to do everything on his own, which is in one sense good, but in the other sense, all of you who are in business know it's not that easy to make a lot of money. And so he has always done business and still is heavily involved in business. But then one day I said, Denver, that's his name, stop trying to do everything yourself. Why don't you let other people join you and help along in this process of rescuing kids? At that very second, he turned around and said, then you will help me raise funds. And since then, I've been in the fundraising business. and that was 2014. In 2014, so now I'm going into the history of Ela 180. In 2014, we were building houses for existing orphanages in our city of Coctemoc, Chihuahua. And there's plenty of orphanages that had very run-down houses. So we started building one house after the other so that these kids would live in better homes than they had been up to till then. And so if you want to forward to the next slide, there's one of the houses, that yellow one. They had 36 kids in that house. And one lady overseeing it and a 67-year-old Spanish pastor of a church. He was kind of the overall overseer of that orphanage. And so we helped him build a new house. You can see a little corner in the back there, but we'll see more pictures of that yet. We helped him build that house, and then we were half done. And then one of the 12-year-old girls in the orphanage got pregnant. So the lady was very upset, and obviously, so she started asking around how come and who did it and whatever all. She could never find out. The girl would never tell her. And she thought maybe one of the boys did it and so on. But time went on, and all of a sudden she hired a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist found out who did it. And it was the 67-year-old pastor, which was very sad. That day, the police came, confiscated the whole building site that we had there, the orphanage and everything. And it took all the kids out that were brought in under the social worker's care, which from the 36, only 12 were left. The rest they took out. And then there was 12 who were brought in privately by different people. And so we couldn't continue building. Nobody was giving to a cause of that. And so that was obvious. 2 weeks later, the government shows up and says, why don't you guys take on the rest of the 12 kids yet too, and then you don't just build a house, you actually run the orphanage. Well, we said if we can have it no strings attached, we will go for it. And they said, have it, do whatever you want. So we took it. From there, it went down to 5 kids because people started taking out more of the kids, aunts and uncles and whatever came and picked up the kids. So it was down to 5 kids. And we continued building, finished the building as quickly as we could. We convinced some investors to help us finish the building. And then in June 14, I think it was, we had our grand opening. So if you can go to the next slide. There's the other side of that old building. You can see the new one in the back. So continue going to the next slide. That's the front of the new building. So we had our grand opening for that building. That was big enough to hold 50 kids. And we, at the time of the grand opening, we were back up to 17 kids. So if you go on to the next slide, there you can see the grand opening. Super excited. We had 17 kids. We opened up, and that was 2014. And from there, we have been growing. So our goal, if you go on to the next slide, you can see the little kids there. Dress them up all pretty. Keep on going to the next one. So now I'll just catch you up to 2021. We started with 17 kids. Well, better said, with 5 kids. That's when we got the orphanage. Our goal is and was to rescue, restore, and equip kids. So we have... in the state of Chihuahua, we have 10,000 homeless kids. In our own local city, we have 300 to 400 homeless kids. Our city is one of the most violent cities in all of Mexico. It is because of the geographical location it is. A lot of the drugs come to Sinaloa. They get transported through the mountains, and then they get dispersed over the border into the United States and Canada. So the reason for so many orphans in our state is our proximity to the U.S. border. Everybody wants to be on that stretch. That's super valuable real estate for the cartels. The cartels, obviously, you know what that is. They're super violent gangs, more powerful than the government often is. In fact, in our area, if you want to get any kind of justice done, often people would rather go to the cartels than to the government, because you can actually get something done. So That being said, they're not always nice. They want their way, and they want their way the way they want it. And that leaves a trail of blood in the way. And homeless kids. There is an incredible amount of violence. We're number one in violence in our country, in violence, physical violence, and also we're number one in family, domestic violence, like family violence. So what many times happens is the wage is very low, the offer from the cartels is very good. Just bring me this one load across the border and I'll give you $30,000 or $10,000 or whatever. Well, that's the equivalent of 10 years of work pretty much for many of them. So it's tempting. So they will do it. Men will often do it. And most of them never come back. They're either hooked on the money or on prostitution or whatever. Or they get killed or they get put in jail or whatever. That leaves the wife and kids at home even worse because now they have down to one income. And so that causes the wife to often give up her kids. Can't do it. Or she prostitutes herself to make more money. And that's the cycle. Now you have a little picture of the cycle of violence. And then they grow up on the streets. And so once you start growing up on the streets, you learn nothing. Our community consists in Chihuahua of about 45,000 Mennonites. And we have all been taught to work hard. Like that is the number one thing that Mennonites get taught, and that is work hard. From sun up till sundown, you work hard. It has its good sides, but it's also not always good to just work. But the good thing is most of them have enough to eat. They're well to do. If you work, the Bible says there is profit in labor, so you can actually make a living. These kids do not have a mom or a dad. So they will grow up not working. They grow up begging, stealing, and doing whatever they can to make a living. And so they start, if you move on to the next slide. Yeah, so our city population is 175,000. We have 300 to 400 homeless kids in our own little hometown city there. 10,000 in the state of Chihuahua. And so we decided, you know what, let's start where we can. Even though it's a drop in the bucket, let's start where we can, and that's where we started growing. And you might say, well, what difference does it make if we take care of one or two or three children? You know what, God multiplies. He's in the multiplication business. He blesses the little bit that we do, and he makes it a lot. He took two fish and five loaves of bread and fed 5,000 men plus women and children. So on that faith, we're going out and we start working and working and working. So now, if you go one slide back, I have mixed them up here a little bit. And this I explained already too. So go further back. Go back. One back. Yeah. So now we're up to 185 kids since 2014. 185 kids that we now have rescued from the streets of Cuauhtémoc. They live in clusters, I should say. They live in little bubbles of 12 to 35 kids. They gather, run down houses, they enter, and that's where they live. And that's their entire lifestyle is just watching other kids do what they do. They have no adult supervision, and they're often as little as 2 years old in that whole circle. And it's being they reproduce at an incredible rate. I'll go on to that a little bit later. So keep going forward to one more. Like I said, the reason for the violence is the U.S. Border proximity, because the value of drugs comes from north of the border, because that's where people have money. And Canada as well. Even if you can bring drugs to Canada, you have hit the jackpot. Like that's even more expensive there. So one thing that I want you to notice is that we as Vida 180 Orphanage and the cartels, we're pulling out of the exact same pool of people all the time. They draw people to further their agenda of violence and crimes and drugs and all that. We draw people to make a difference in God's kingdom. But it's the same people. oftentimes when you see violence happening, it is from very young kids, young boys, 12, 13, 16-year-olds. Just the other day, there was another abduction, and the guy that saw it right in front of him, he said the oldest ones were probably 16 years old, old with big machine guns and stuff. So it's young kids that do that. So again, they're using it for their kingdom. We're using these kids for God's kingdom, as you will see in a little bit. Keep going further. For example, a little guy like that, he is now, I think he's 13. But when he came in, he was 8. And here's the interesting thing. We've done this more often. Boys come in, and we'll sit them down, and we'll ask them, so what do you want to do when you grow up? And they'll look you straight in the eye, and with pride say, I want to murder people. I literally want to torture them. I don't want to kill them necessarily, but I want to torture them. Others say, I want to kill them. I want to be a part of the gangs. 8 years old, and it's already ingrained in them that this is what they want to do. I don't know how in the world Satan accomplishes that at that age, but he does. So it's in there. So that's one part that we have to train out of there. What we've done sometimes is we have gotten ex-cartels, people in there, to speak to these kids and tell them what the reality is. And that has changed the culture a lot, because many of these guys come in there and say, you know what, all this glamour that you see being advertised, it is not that at all. You can never sit down in peace in a restaurant and drink your own Coke and eat a meal, because you don't know where the next bullet is going to come from. So there is none of that pride that they all talk about. So that's what happens to boys. They will collect these boys effectively. They will have these little burrito stands on the side of the road. They are often owned by the cartels. But then these guys will come up. They'll ask for food. But the guy that's selling them burritos, he is looking. And if he sees a guy like that, that looks bright and sharp, he will call his superior. And he'll tell him, look, got a guy here. He looks like high potential. Why don't you come and check him out? And so he does. Comes and checks him out. And they, not necessarily that they force him in there, but he'll offer him, hey, you know what? Are you tired of sleeping under the bridge? I got a job for you. It's paying well, and you know what? You can even have your own vehicle if you want. Well, these guys fall for it head first because they're tired of being hungry and sleeping under the bridge. So they go for it, and that's where the violence starts. They train them to become their own soldiers. Go to the next slide, please. Sex slavery is another one. This is unbelievable what you'll encounter there, but sex slavery has become more profitable than drugs itself. The latest numbers I've heard is you can clear $500,000 per year from every single girl you can get your hands on. Like, they kidnap them and they own them as slaves, and then they sell them as sex slaves to others. Go to the next slide. This little girl, she was sold by her own mom to the sex slave trade at the age of 5. And she is, on that picture, she's 10 years old. And so that's all she has done since the age of 5 till the age of 10, was being a sex slave. Go to the next slide, please. That's her baby. She is 10 years old. Literally, we got her when she was 9 months pregnant. The same month we got her, she actually gave birth to that little baby girl. And she's 10 years old. So just imagine the reproduction cycle, how fast it happens. We've had many of them that say that they have been in the sex slave trade. Some of them as young as 9 have been pregnant. It's unbelievable, but that's what's happening. And so the drug cartels, or many of them, are turning more and more to this source of income. Reason being, if you have actual drugs, you have to somehow get them across the border, which is incredibly dangerous. You can get caught, you can get whatever, all kinds of stuff. If you have this source of income, you stay at home. The money comes to you. It's just all around so much better for them. But then the hurt is the girls. So the guys are being trained to be violent killers, and the girls are being sold as sex slaves, and either way, money is the king that rules in this whole thing. So keep going. Next slide, please. So what we do from the streets, we just pick them up. Sometimes they're being brought to us by police, sometimes by the grandparents. The dads are 99% of the time never involved in their lives. They don't know who their dad is. The moms are oftentimes prostitutes who just simply cannot take care of their own family. And even if there's a good-hearted mom that wants to provide, we've run into situations like Monday morning the mom leaves to go to work in a bigger city of Chihuahua. And she stays there till Saturday afternoon because she's working in a factory. Saturday afternoon, she comes back. She has four kids at home. The oldest is 7 years old. So she doesn't want to prostitute herself. She doesn't want to do all these bad things. So what's she going to do? Well, she charges the seven-year-old to take care of her three younger siblings. Incredible. So that's where we rescue them from. Many different scenarios where they come from. Oftentimes, we'll have cases like the grandma calling us up and saying, I cannot do this anymore. I don't know where my daughter is. She hasn't been around in 5 months. She left her kids with me. I can't feed them anymore. I don't know what to do. Could you please get these kids? So we'll get those kids. And then we go there, and the situation is horrendous. Oftentimes, there's a dad that has the same situation. Moral standards, as you well know, they're low everywhere, but I believe in particular they're low in Mexico. So the other day, for example, we had a 75-year-old man call us, and he told us, you know what, my wife of 30 years old, like he had a 30-year-old wife, left me some weeks ago. Here is four kids. I'm 75. I cannot take care of these at all, so please just take them. Another one of those, he was also a dad, he gave us a call and said, please come and get these kids, I don't know what to do with them. They're not even mine, they're my grandkids or my great-grandkids, who knows what. One of them he had tied to a tree for a number of years already, it was a boy. When we got him in, he made noises like a dog, because he was tied side by side with a dog. And he ate like a dog. Like if we put a plate of food in front of him, he wouldn't even take the spoon. He didn't know what a spoon was. He just ate like that. So that's the situation. Him we could not rescue. He was too far gone, so we brought him to a mental home. We're not ready to have mentally impaired kids there. We're just simply not ready at this point to do that. So we brought him to another place. His two sisters, though, we could keep them. We were able to rescue them. So the next thing what we do is we restore them. We give them a home, first of all, a place to sleep, place to eat, a place to belong. We give them a family. They have a lot of siblings in this home. We give them back their dignity. They feel like they're worthless. Like literally that's all they've been communicated to all their life. Like you're worthless. Everything in society says you're worthless. We give them back their dignity. And how we do that is we do not pity them when they come in. We tell them, look, you are made by God for a purpose. It is very sad what has happened to you. We realize that and we recognize that. But now you're here. Now you're one of us. There will be enough food here to eat. There will be beds to sleep in. But you have to carry your weight. You have to make your own bed. You have to help us make the food. You have to help us keep the house clean. And in my house, that was part of the job that all our kids did. We taught them how to take care of themselves, to become productive. We teach the same thing to these kids. And what it does is it gives them back their dignity. Oh, I can actually do something. Oh, this is nice. Very soon they forget that they're just beggars. They start realizing, no, I have value too. Because look at my room. I take care of my room. I take care of my bed. I help make meals. I keep the yard and whatever else. Okay, so that's the smaller ones. What we have done now is we have 10 girls, boys and girls separate, obviously completely separate, but we have 10 girls per room, 10 boys per room. And that's how we have split them up, and we put the older ones and the younger ones together so that the younger ones learn from the older ones. At one point, we did it different. We had the young ones separated and the old ones separated. But we realized all the stuff we teach the older ones does not get necessarily transferred to the younger ones because they're not together. Now we put them together. We put a captain in each room from the older boys, let's say, and he's in charge over his entire room. He's in charge to help his littler guys make their own beds, to teach them the values that we have taught him. The same thing with the girls. So they're learning one from the other. The younger ones are learning from the older ones. At the same time, what we realize what happens is the older ones are now getting leadership skills. They're realizing, oh, I can lead. Another thing that it has done is in the home that we now have, the new one, I'll show you in a minute, we have over 100 kids there. The home mom, it takes her 15 minutes a day to give all 100 kids a job for the day. All she does is she decides what each room is going to do. She goes and puts a magnet by the room and says, you guys are in charge of dishwashing or of mopping or of whatever it is. And then the captain of that room walks out in the morning and he says, all right, guys, looks like today we're sweeping the floor. So everybody get to work. And so that's how she delegates the responsibility of keeping the house to all of them. And it works like clockwork. It's just beautiful. If you all of a sudden have a chance to come and look, I would invite you more than welcome to come and check it out, because it is amazing what you see there. That's how we give them their dignity back. Security, well, we place them in there. We give them a secure home. We have fences around there, not so much for them to not run out, but for the others not to come in. So there's security. There's love there. It is amazing what you feel when you walk in there. And this is something purely honor, glory to God. Me and my brother-in-law have been asking ourselves this since the beginning, since 2014 till now. But when you walk in there, you feel the peace of God, like literally. I have had a number of grown men walk in there and start crying almost immediately. And sometimes I wonder, okay, so what in the world is going on? And the guys will be asking, what is it that I'm feeling? Like I feel something here. I can't say exactly what it is, other than the presence of God is there very, very strongly. I've been doing this now for 7 years, going to the orphanage, touring people, exposing what we're doing so that there's more knowledge about it. In those 7 years, I have yet to come there and encounter a fight amongst the kids. I have not found a fight yet. There's 185 kids right now. I have not seen a fight. The other day I had three couples come in there, and one of their first questions is, how do you keep control of these kids? And I was like, do you have a little bit of time? Yeah, we do. I said, stick around and watch for yourselves. So I stuck around for 3 hours with all the kids present. At the end of the 3 hours, I asked them again, so did you see any fights going on? Not one. There was three couples. They had been watching. Not one fight happened. How is that possible? Is there no fights? No, there is fights. But so little that I have yet to encounter one coming in there. So we are super thankful to God that he has filled that place with his presence so strongly that we can literally see lives change nonstop. Another thing that happens, we preach the gospel to these kids. We preach Christ crucified on the cross and raised from the dead. And he's the only way to heaven. Last year we had 40 kids get baptized, accepting Christ and getting baptized, which was amazing. We really, really enjoyed seeing that. Every single day, at the end of the day, we gather them together at about 9 o'clock, from 9 to 9:30. There's a devotional. There's a teaching of God's word. There's a sharing time, praying amongst the kids so that they can firsthand see this is how you serve the living God. This is what he says in his word towards us. This is what he says about you guys. Because many of them have never, ever seen anything like this. So that's another thing that we constantly do. We also have a Spanish pastor who is helping us oversee this. But now that we have so many kids, his church is too small to hold them all. So now we do church inside the orphanage. We prepared a place where we can actually literally do that. So the next thing is we equip them, like I said, with the gospel, and then with school. We give them private school. Who is familiar with the homeschooling curriculum, ABECA? Anybody? That's what these kids are getting. We order that from Florida, I think that's where their headquarters are. And so everybody gets a backup. We teach them English, we teach them computers, we teach them math, reading, and writing. And those are the five main things that we teach them in school. Because we think that that is what they need to be successful in life. Next thing is work. We find work for them. Along the corridor, Jim, you've been at the corridor, right? That's 40 kilometers of businesses. There's 1,051 businesses on that stretch. And so there's plenty of work. So we go around asking people, hey, do you have work for these kids? Or, well, what do you have? Well, I have a boy or a girl. Whatever. Now we have 18 of these that are 17 and up that are working full time. Some of the boys, we take them to the ranch. We have a ranch where we grow onions. A lot of labor, very labor intense. We teach these boys to drive tractors, to do whatever. So the boys often go there to work. The girls work in restaurants. They work in hotels. They work in offices and whatever we can find. We teach them finances, how to budget. We teach them to give. They know nothing about money. They've never had money in their life. So we have to start at the basics. We call it, in Spanish, we call it banbote. It is the, what would you call it, the box bank. Because we give them boxes. Each one has their own box. And then we have giving. And then we have saving. And then we have your living expenses. And then when you get your check, here's how you divide it. Basically, in other words, we just teach them basic budgeting. That's all. So each one sees firsthand, this is what it looks like. Sports. We have very good sports programs. The boys are now in soccer, and they have been playing 20 games statewide, and they've only lost 3. So they're like one of the top teams. So you got to keep this in mind. These are, if you want to call it that, bottom of the barrel, dirty kids from the street. Now are in sports and they're doing well. They have been given dignity back. You are somebody. They're playing with multi-million dollar kids on the same field. Many of these other kids don't know that these are street kids. 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, that kid was on the street and he's beating you now. They don't know that, but they start getting to know that. Music. We're blessed with teachers in our schools, teachers that are talented in music. Most of them are talented in music as well as just teaching. So after school, oh, there's music going on. Big time music. Praise and, we have our own praise and worship team from the kids. We've been teaching them and teaching them and teaching. Oftentimes, we go and we grab a kid off the street. 4 months later, plays the guitar very nicely. So you can teach these kids. Like, these are gold mines, literally. There's so much potential in each one of these kids if just somebody will take a little bit of time. So that's the equip part of it. Let's move on to the next. So there's a new building. We built that last year, started in March, and we finished December 13. That building, we thought it held 150 kids, and now we find out it's plenty big enough for 200 kids. So we're very happy for that. We only need to build 2 walls in each room, and then we have 10 kids per room, which will bring it up to 200 kids that we can easily hold in there. Go on to the next, please. Another picture from the other side. So let's move on to the next. There's the whole family. It's a little bit of on the inside there. And I believe this is the last one. Maybe not. Oh, there's the kitchen. Look at that. This is when we had them all over. So we have 2 locations now. We have the existing one that I told you we built in 2014. That one holds 120 kids. This one holds 200 kids, this building. So just so you know what our plan is for the future, I think there is another picture. Can we go to the next, please? Yeah, very blurry, but if you look on this side here, this is a highway. This is one of the main highways there. And then there's a little green stretch. So this is our piece of land. Let's just say it that way. We are buying this piece of land in third sections. The first section from the back here, we already bought that. This year we're planning to buy the second section, and then as we get money in, that's how we keep buying it. And we get the title according to how we buy it. So our plan is, as you see there, here's the highway. We want to put 3 businesses in front here. There is 3 businessmen who one of them has already fully agreed. He wants to put a restaurant there, and then we want to put a car mechanic shop and a convenience store. All of them with the purpose of giving work to the kids. All employees he has there are supposed to come from that orphanage. That's the condition. And it's a very enviable stretch of land because it's right on a busy highway. So businesses are eager to build something there. And the rent will obviously just go as a donation to the children's home. But the main point is we want to have work for these kids. We want to teach them how to work, to become productive human citizens of our country. The next you can see is a little lot of lines there. That's a parking lot. And then we have a school with a gym. The school will fit 600 kids. So this is just our future plan, just so you know. 600 kids, and then the gym is supposed to hold up to 1,200 people. And that we will rent to the pastor of our town, the one that's now taking care of the kids, so that he can have his church in there, because his church is very small. He can't keep all our kids plus his people in there. So that's the plan. Next is two soccer fields. And then you see two brown spots on top. Can you see that? Yeah. The first one is the orphanage that I just showed you, the big white one. That one's already there. Next to that is another, the same one. So we're planning to build, not this year, but next year, we're planning to build another one. And then the third one is the same thing. So we'll have three orphanages the same size. Each will hold 200 kids. And then there's a bit of a greenhouse, gardens type of deal. And at the end, there's a street with 14 houses. Those 14 houses we will be building this year yet. Those are very small houses. We call them Infonavit houses. And they are small enough that these kids that are working can start buying them. Because in real life, nobody gets given a house. You have to work for it. And so we want to teach these kids, you work for your house. But we will be sort of the bank, and they can buy it off of us over 10-year payments. With this in mind, that the wage they're getting is sufficient to be able to live and make these payments so that they can actually save up something. We're ready, before we have built it already, now they have over a year already been saving to buy their own house. So that's the whole plan. This year we'll finish that stretch to 14 houses yet, and then they can start building, buying their house. If they get married, they move in there. The reason being is we want to keep them closer for a little bit longer, because if we just grab these kids, teach them for a few years and send them back out there, well, it's very doubtful what will happen. Our plan is, and we don't have an age limit, the youngest one right now is 4 months, the baby that you saw there, the oldest one is 19. Our plan is hopefully we can keep these kids till 23. Because then we feel like, okay, 23, there's a tipping point that now you start seeing, okay, I think these guys are solid enough, they can be on their own. And then if the house becomes too small, no problem. Sell us the house and you have the money, you go buy yourself a different one and now you're on your own. We won't be babysitting these kids forever, like we can't. We will treat them exactly like we do our own kids. As you well know, all of you who have kids, some of your kids are mature at the age of 18 and others takes till 21 or 22 or whatever. And so hopefully not 30, but but that is the plan. So the current plan has room for 700 kids once all completed. Obviously, we only have one orphanage there yet. We have the structure built now, the foundation, the septic, the hydro, the road and everything, so that we can just build the other two on there. We don't need to do that yet. That we have all done this last year. So that is a little bit of an overview of our future plan. That is one campus that will hold 600 kids with a school and a church and everything. And then we're thinking, okay, there's still over 9,000 more kids, so what are we going to do with those? So our plan is to copy and paste this idea close to other cities as well. Chihuahua, Delicias, Juarez, and all those cities are going to get one of these campuses right next to the whole thing. So yeah, let's go on to the next slide. One more. Okay, so here's our need. Operating the orphanage is very expensive sometimes, it seems like. So our cost currently is $250 per month per child total. What this includes food, clothing, doctor bills. It includes the school curriculum. It includes all the teachers. It includes the home parents, the night staff. It includes the maintenance on the buildings. It includes the vehicle maintenance place to the next, because that's where we have the school. It includes everything that happens on campus. To give you a perspective, private schooling in Mexico, most of our Mennonite people are sending their kids to private schools. The cost for sending your kids in Mexico to a private school is $250 per month. And that is just the school. That does not include clothing, food, and absolutely everything else, hydro bills and propane and all that. We think we are able to do it very, very cheap. We have flown to Africa to check out similar orphanages, and we are almost half the cost as what they do in Africa for the same type of deal. So in that sense, it is very, very affordable. We've brought it down to like a very affordable level. What we've done now is split it in five, the $250 per month per child, that's total. We split it amongst five people. And now five people can join with $50 a month if they want to. And then it's easier. That way, at one point I had it only at $250 and that's it. But then I found that a lot of the working people in Mexico, like just the day wage people, could not at all afford it. Like, there was no way that they could participate. So we split it in five, $50 a month, and there you have it. Now we have opened the field to many more donors to help us along. One thing to note, the administration fees are not covered from the donations. We have a private firm who has agreed that they will cover all administration fees. Everything that's administration that does not directly go to the child, they'll take care of that. And that is partly why we can operate so much cheaper than they do in Africa and many other orphanages, is because really the total cost, if we accounted all administration, it would be much higher. But there is some investors that have said, you know what, we'll take care of that completely. So whatever the cost of administration, we'll do that. And then donations, any type of donations, they go 100% to feeding the orphans. Yeah. So that's, in a nutshell, a little bit of what we're doing, where we're heading. And any questions so far? Anything? Yes.
Are you finding that the cartels are creating problems for you in any way when they see what you're doing?
No, not yet. Not yet. We have had one case where the home parents had to go to jail because they were accused of kidnapping children. So what happened was the grandma called us and said, please come get these kids. And some neighbors down the street didn't like it. They called the police, and then before they were back to the home, they were already caught by the police. And then we just had to go to the police station and tell them, look, here's what we're doing. And they were released within an hour. That's the only problem we have run into so far. Overall, the cartels are very sensitive to kids. You'd be very surprised when it's little kids how they really want to protect them. But then when they grow to a little bit older and they start losing their compassion and start using them for their own use. Yes?
How about sickness? Do you have much sickness for the children over there?
No. Somehow the herd immunity, I think, keeps them strong. When COVID hit, the government people came and like they wanted to everywhere, shut everything down. They just stood there kind of like, I don't know what we're going to do here, so you just keep going. And we just kept going. Have lost nobody. Everybody's... they come in. As far as like sickness, so here's the thing. They come in malnourished often. Malnourished, they underfed. So that brings with it its own set of problems, right? When they come in, they most of the time they are so dirty and so full of bugs, like this size bugs that are on their head. We just had like last week. we shave their heads completely, and then you have to start giving them medication and clean them up and whatever all. So we have a doctor that keeps a close eye on that, that they will start developing. And since there's so many kids coming in, we still have, over the next 2 weeks, we'll be getting over 20 kids in still. And all of these have to be checked up, and so there's always something. And if you have 185 kids running around, stuff happens. They bang their toe, they fall off the chair, and they whatever also. As far as sickness, what I remember is one that had a very serious sickness, and that was a kidney failure issue. And that one we had to doctor with a lot. Yeah, but other than that, their overall health is pretty good. But there's, like every single day, the other day I asked the doctor lady, she said about 3 to 5 cases a day that she tends to. But those are not like major cases of like cancer and such. They're more like a little banged up here and issue there and so on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How about the people from the south that came up from South America, Central America? Mm-hmm.
For some reason, they never crossed past our town. They were further south, or west, I should say, Tijuana and all those, or they were on the east coast, Matamoros. That's where they were entering. Yeah. Yeah, it's a 20-hour drive from where we are. Yeah. Yeah. Any questions? Jim? There is plenty of boys coming up that will start working in those shops locally. Yeah. Yes.
So if we wanted to come visit your place down there, is it, you said it's 5 hours from here?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, how far is it from here to the border?
About an hour.
Yeah, then it is 5 hours to Cuauhtemoc.
Okay.
Yeah. Hour and a half out of Chihuahua, yeah. That's right. Cuauhtemoc is our city. Yeah.
Would it be safe to travel over there, being the cartel is there? And I've heard a lot of stories that they rob people on the
way. No, they're not robbing people on the way. That is not the cartels. We haven't seen a robbery like that in a very long time. In fact, I'll tell you a little bit how the cartels like to operate, and that is they like it when it's peaceful. The more peaceful it is, the better they can move their stuff. They don't want any kind of uproar anywhere because that exposes everybody. They want to be quiet. Cartels, we've lived there now for 14 years, and we've not had a single encounter with cartels. Not a single one. Does it happen right around us? If you mess with their territory, you will be dead the next day. Just don't go where they don't want you to go. And don't mess with their business. And they'll leave you alone. In fact, they'll be protecting you because they want peace. That's a good idea. I've not thought about that yet, but there would be a lot of money there to be had. Yeah. Maybe you should pray for me that I would find the right guy there. We might be getting from them, but not that I know of. So in the community we live in, it's a well-to-do community. Well, Jim, you know how it looks. They'll be living right among us, our neighbors. No, I never feel that I will be attacked. We had a neighbor for a long time. He was one of the top hitmen. Like, he went and killed others. He was a Mennonite. Yes, many of the Mennonites are involved. In fact, they are often the leaders. I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. And so they will be very, very respectful. They will live in $500,000 houses, $1 million houses. They'll be your neighbor. They'll go for a walk with their dog. They'll have nice little babies.
How did you come to find out that they were hitmen?
Oh, nothing stays quiet. Yeah. Word just gets out. It always does. Yeah.
My
Yeah. Yeah.
The administrations, the administrative staff, and the teachers, and the other adults who are working there, are they coming from within the community? Are they coming from the States? Do you have people that come in as missionaries and work for a period of time?
Most of our teachers are locals. They live in the town. They're well-educated people. They're the teachers. The home parents are definitely from locally. The first home parents we had there, they're still there, but we have now two houses, so we have two home parents. The first ones were directly sent from God. Well, I think all of them, but super, super good born-again Christians. They know how to handle kids. Unbelievable. They're in their 50s. It's a couple. And the other one is a young couple. They're in their 20s. So those are all local. We have three people that come from outside. Two English teachers came from Canada. They just wanted to teach for 3 months. But it's 4 years now, so they never went back. So they really like it. And one other lady, she is from a different colony about 2 hours away. And she's also teaching full-time. She's a Mennonite. But most of them are Spanish. Most of our workers are Spanish. Somehow they understand the culture better, and it works real well. Yeah.
You were telling me, if you find them on the street, the government doesn't help, but if the government finds them and brings them, they help you all a little bit, don't they?
Yes, they do, a little bit. We have, I don't even know the number now exactly, but I would say about 20-30% that have been brought in by the government. The DIF is the social worker system in Mexico. If they bring them in, they help us along with 1,900 pesos, 1,800 per month per child. And so it's $100. Yeah, and it costs us 250 to run it. So that's the only help we're getting, is just for those kids and just $100, but our cost is at 250, so that's per month. Yeah. Yeah. That's the way it is. But they've been very kind to us, the government, the governor of Chihuahua and his wife. They came for the grand opening. The lady, she is in charge over the orphanages, and most orphanages get run so disastrous. She wanted to shut every orphanage down that there was in the state of Chihuahua. She was already in the process of doing it when one day one of her employees showed up at our orphanage, and then that employee went back to her and said, "Lady, before you do anything more, come and check this out." In 1 week, she came with all her bodyguards and everything, and she was one of them that just cried and cried and cried and couldn't stop. She had never seen something like this. So we have 56 orphanages in all of Chihuahua. The next largest to us has capacity for 60 people. And so that gives you a little perspective on where we're at. Yeah.
You spoke about you have a church service on the weekend.
Yeah.
And then you have devotion at night.
Mm-hmm.
Do you start the day with the children with prayer?
Yes. They get up at 6 in the morning, every day, 6 in the morning, and then they have half an hour devotions in the morning. That's more so a short teaching or an encouragement and a prayer with the kids, because they're all still kind of sleepy and whatever all. And then we give them breakfast and then off to school. At 3 they come back and then they eat lunch. In between they have a snack and at school. But then at night, at 9 o'clock at night, 9:30, they're supposed to be in bed. At 9, we get them together, and then we let them share a little bit, speak about their day, and we pray with them and stuff like that. Yes. So, yeah, that is any more questions? I'm willing to answer any kind of questions you guys have. But if not, I don't want to take too much time. I don't know what your plan is. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But you plan to buy the next
The next third this year.
This year.
Yeah.
And is the current landowner holding the other third?
Yes. He's a good friend of ours. He will not hold it forever, obviously. But he's a gracious guy. He knows what we're doing. And so he has given it to us on payments, we could say. But he only gives us the title for the part that we paid. So we don't owe the rest of the land, but we have the option to buy it. So it's not like we have debt, but he's also waiting for us to make the payment, yeah.
And how many acres?
25 acres.
How much is
that? That is 25 acres, it's $26,000 an acre. Yeah. It's close to the city. And he left it at a much cheaper price than it actually was just because it went for an orphanage. So,
how far north of Fort Campbell is the orphanage?
You know where the bank is, the Ukaksa Bank?
Uh-huh.
You know how you turn around there and you go to the city of Chihuahua? This is on that stretch. This is 2 kilometers from the, 3 kilometers from the bank.
Oh, okay.
It is... That road divides the Mennonite land from the Spanish land. The city goes up to that road, and then after that road is agricultural land. On that land, that's where it is. So it's like right next to the city. It is prime property, yeah. It is. You can see it from Renee's shop. That's how close it is. It's right close there, yeah. That's dollars. Yeah. That comes out to, I don't even know what, $600,000 for just the land. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. So another thing where we are blessed with, and that is an organization called FACHUC. It's an organization where all of the businesses in Chihuahua, they pay 1% of their tax into that. The government adds another percent on there. In 1990s, there was a big flood, and the government could not help the people in a different city there in Chihuahua. And then they said, ask the business people, can we somehow count on you guys to help us rescue these kids, I mean these people? And then a group of businessmen came together and said, yes, and this is how we're going to do it. Why don't we raise the tax by 1% and you give us 1% of the money you get from taxes anyway? We put that in a fund and we personally manage that, like the business people. It's a privately owned thing, but the government still is putting, up until now at least, the current government wants to shut that down, but we have been able to fight hard enough to keep it afloat. They are helping us greatly with this because they deeply believe in the mission that we have here. They have paid for the building, not the land. For the building, they paid 40% last year. And at the grand opening, they verbally promised to help us 70% with the next building. That's just the building, not the land or anything else. And so that has been a very big blessing. Another thing what we've been doing is me and my wife have been traveling a lot, just like we're doing now. We've been up in Canada, and so we've found some people who also have bought into the vision, deeply believe in it, and they're helping us along as well. So what we're in essence doing is we're going out and we're looking for partners whom God has chosen and who feel that want to partner with us in this mission. I am fully aware of the fact that there's needs everywhere. This is not the only need in the world. You guys, like you were saying in the beginning, you're helping 7 missions or something. So there's plenty of need. All around you guys, your country has plenty of needs. This is just one of those. But my heart is, and I've told God and I promised him, I will do my part. That is lay the vision in front of people. His part is to show us who are the people that he wants to have partner with us and go the road of rescuing kids. That's all. That's pretty much all that that we do. Denver, my brother-in-law, same thing. He says, you know what? He's a big dreamer. I like to dream big as well, but sometimes he stretches my imagination. He'll come up with a plan that is usually literally 100% impossible to do. Unless God steps in, there is no way we can do this. We did not have $1 of the dollars that we needed for the entire new orphanage. Not $1. At the end of the year, it was done. The year before that, we did the same thing. Me and him sat down and we said, okay, beginning of the year, what do we want to see this year happen? Well, we need a school bus. We need this. We need this. We need this. We need this. We put an amount where we believe that this is what it would cost. It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. We just basically said, okay, God, you know what? We're believing you for this. And that's it. We're going to do our part. You're going to do your part. Let's see how far we get. Jump in there by faith and see how far it goes. And so that's kind of our motto is going like that. The same thing with the ranch. The ranch that we have there was the same thing. We need sustainable income. And I had been telling Denver for a long time, look, this is too risky to just have a few big donors. What if one of them goes bankrupt? Big portion of our money is gone. Can't do that. We have to do more. So then me and my wife went to Alberta 5 years ago and talked to some people, and they said, you know what? We'll help you build a ranch for the orphanage. So it's privately run, but with the intent of giving as much money as we can to the orphanage. It has been helping us greatly to cash flow. So we're doing everything possible, every which way. Let it be sponsors for one child, Fichok, the business people, the ranch. We're looking every direction that we can to build something up that's solid, that's sustainable, that can run in the long run, and see how many kids we can rescue. Make heaven fuller and hell emptier, right? And I believe, I'm one of those, I don't know, but I don't believe we're going to be here for very long. Amen. I think this world is coming to an end very fast. And that just puts a little more fire under you. And you know what? Now we're still alive. Let's do this. Let's see how many kids we can put into heaven before Jesus comes back. So that's pretty much yesterday.
You said you were set up in the United States for the video.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah, that's right. So we are registered in Mexico, fully registered to give donation receipts. We're fully registered in the United States as an orphanage here, as a nonprofit organization. We can give you tax deduction receipts, and you deposit just in a Wells Fargo bank account. We are also registered in Canada to do the same thing, just so that we are covered in all different areas. In case you guys choose to long-term sponsor a child and then you would like a receipt, my wife back there can take your information, and we will be in contact. We'll let you know how that works and where that works.
Website where you can do these things electronically? Is that up?
For in the U.S., I'm not sure if we have that. PayPal, you can. Yeah, PayPal, you can. But in Canada, we have, it's called Canada Helps, and many of the U.S. donors have been doing the same thing. Canada Helps is a website you go in, and with, I think, 4 clicks, you're done. You're set up with your credit card, monthly giving, and all that stuff. Canada Helps takes 2% for managing the funds, but other than that, it's they convert to their money, and then we just get it over to Mexico. But you just donate in your own money, whatever you want. Like, you don't need to think about converting or anything like that. Or was that not your question?
It is the question, but you know, the U.S. dollar is worth more.
Yeah.
If we went directly to pesos versus via the Canada dollar, and then pesos.
Oh, okay.
Money,
yeah. I think it for you guys here, it's better through PayPal. Yeah.
You told me you had an address in El Paso, didn't you? Post office box.
Yep. You can mail a check. Yeah, totally. Many have done that already. If that's easier for you, I can give you that address. You just mail it, and it gets deposited into Wells Fargo. I'm not thinking of that because in Mexico we don't have a mailing system. It doesn't exist. So. Next to nothing. Next to nothing. It does not really count. And here's the sad story. Why? I've been asking that question too. Like, why do you not recognize this? And back to our cartel story. I know you're maybe old of that, but there is literally thousands of orphanages that exist only on paper, and they're owned by the cartels. And here is why. If you guys send money to Mexico, you don't pay taxes, or we don't pay taxes on the money that we take out, because it's a donation, right? So the cartels have an incredibly hard time getting the money back over to Mexico. It is almost impossible. It's harder to get the money back to Mexico than it is the drugs here. So they open up an organization out there. It's called an orphanage. And then they have cash money here from selling their drugs. They go deposit that money into the orphanage account here in the U.S. and they take it out there.
Laundering.
Through an orphanage. So it doesn't even exist. There is no building many times. It's just in the clouds type of thing. And then the government finds out about all these things and then they start clamping down. Oh, you're an orphanage? Oh, let's see. What do you do? Where do you get your money from? They're looking at us this closely. And for good reason, but sometimes you feel like, this is just wrong. Look at what we're doing. And you're watching us like hawks. Like, come on, use your brains. But then when you find out so many are using it the wrong way, then you can understand better. Yeah. But yeah, like as far as sending checks, you can just mail them to El Paso address. That works, yeah. Thanks for reminding me on that. Yeah. Anything else? I don't have a time, so you guys will have to chase me off here. Oh, I do have a time. That's right. All right. I'll pray over you guys, if that's okay. Yes. Oh, yeah. That's a good idea. Thank you very much. We have these cards along that we've just made from each kid separately. Not nearly all of them, because lately we've been getting in 40-some kids. And so we haven't made new cards, but we have a bunch of cards along. If you want to sponsor a child, she'll help you with filling it out, and you get the picture, and you can know exactly which child you have sponsored. Put it on your fridge. Pray for them. They pray for you guys. It's amazing. Every morning when we let them pray, they will always thank for the donors that helped them live off the streets. So that is a neat little thing to watch. But yeah, she'll help you with filling those out, and then we'll be in communication from then on.
Are the children from the street free to come to you and say, I want to be a part of this?
If they want to, yeah. Yeah.
And then are they free to leave and go back if for some reason they're
not? Small children we would never let go. 12 and up, when we've gotten them in at the age of 12, 13, 14, they have experienced so much from the outside world that sometimes they say, you know what, this is not for me, I'm going back. And then we don't force them there. We let them go. Because they're used to living on the street. It's not happened many times, but it has happened. Like if they're addicted to drugs, they can't get drugs here. If they're addicted to sex, they can't get sex here. So then sometimes the addiction will take over and they'll just leave. But we will not just say, oh, you want to leave? Go. No, we'll spend days talking with them, convincing them, trying to convince them. We'll ask people to pray and whatever all to change the situation. It's not just like that, now you can go. But if at the end of all of that, they say, I want to leave, all right, then leave.
Do you somehow advertise,
So what we do is the home parents go around and they talk to kids and they know exactly where these clusters of kids are. So the word spreads very quickly. But the thing is, it's being mistrusted so badly that who are these people? I don't know who you. I don't know if you're going to sell my kidney, because that's the other part, selling parts on the black market. Many of these kids are being chopped up into parts and sold. Somebody needs a kidney, $300,000 if you have a kidney. And so oftentimes they pull back because they're afraid of that. But then you have to be there physically enough that they start trusting you. And then the word starts spreading. You can trust these people, and then one by one. We don't put posters up or anything like, no. But we're in the city every single day going with these kids and talking. And like the word is out. People know.